This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Within a 24-hour period, at least 4,000 people have died globally from the COVID-19 virus, about 1,000 of those occurring in the United States. The number of infections globally is now approximately 11.6 million, more than 2.9 million in the United States. The top U.S. infectious disease expert, Anthony Fauci, said during a conversation with National Institutes of Health Director Francis Collins that the United States is still knee-deep in the first wave of the coronavirus pandemic. New York officials say hospitals there released more than 6,300 recovering coronavirus patients into nursing homes during the height of the pandemic under a controversial now-scrapped policy. But they argued it was not to blame for one of the nation's highest nursing home death tolls. Governor Andrew Cuomo's administration, which has taken intense criticism over the policy, instead contended the virus' rampant spread through the state's nursing homes was propelled by more than 20,000 infected home staffers, many of whom kept going to work unaware they had the virus in March and April. Another 17,000 workers were infected through early June. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau Monday turned down an invitation to visit the White House this week because of the coronavirus. The free trade agreement among the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Federal prosecutors say a West Virginia woman who had served in the Air Force planned to offer classified information to the Russian government. Prosecutors Monday announced that Elizabeth Jo Shirley of Hedgeville pleaded guilty as part of a plea agreement to one count each of willful retention of national defense information and international parental kidnapping. Prosecutors say she took her daughter to Mexico in July 2019 with the intent of contacting Russian government representatives there. This is VOA News. A senior diplomat said Tuesday that North Korea has no intention to sit down with the United States and urged South Korea to stop meddling. It comes just as a U.S. envoy was due to visit Seoul in an effort to renew stalled nuclear talks with Pyongyang. Kwon Jong-gun, Director General for the U.S. Affairs at Pyongyang's Foreign Ministry, accused South Korea of misinterpreting Vice Foreign Minister Cho Sun-hui's earlier statement dismissing an untimely rumor about another summit between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and U.S. President Donald Trump. Cho said on Saturday that North Korea does not feel the need for a new summit days after South Korean President Moon Jae-in, who offered to mediate between Kim and Trump, suggested the two leaders meet again before the U.S. elections in November. Ghislaine Maxwell, the alleged accomplice of the late financier Jeffrey Epstein, has been moved to a jail in New York. That's according to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, where she faces charges of facilitating a sex trafficking ring. 58-year-old Maxwell was arrested Thursday in New Hampshire and had been held over the weekend at a medium security facility 20 miles from the luxurious home, where investigators said she had been lying low. The defendant is being held at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, New York. Prosecutors have accused Maxwell, the daughter of the late British media magnate Robert Maxwell, of luring and grooming underage girls so that Epstein could sexually abuse them. In some cases, Maxwell herself participated in the abuse, according to an indictment unsealed last week. Maxwell is expected to make her first appearance in court in Manhattan this week on four criminal counts related to procuring and transporting minors for illegal sex acts and two counts of perjury. She faces up to 35 years in prison if she's convicted. Two sons of former Panamanian President Ricardo Martinelli were arrested in Guatemala City Monday and face extradition to the United States on money laundering charges. Luis Enrique and Ricardo Alberto Martinelli were detained at the main international airport as they attempted to board a flight to Panama. The two are wanted in the United States for a conspiracy to commit money laundering. That's according to the Guatemalan police, but for now will remain in custody in the Central American country. The Martinelli family said in a statement that it is working to ensure the sons have legal assistance in Guatemala and are able to transfer the proceedings to Panama. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi's new president has been inaugurated with a promise to develop the country.
We must have the courage to face and endure the pain of systematic surgery if we ever want to enjoy wholeness as a nation.
Ghana has its first female vice presidential nominee. Eswatini schools reopened yesterday after teachers say the government threatened them with dismissal and no work, no pay. Gambian police have charged a prominent human rights activist with false information. And Kenya's president eases COVID-19 restrictions even as cases continue to soar.
By reopening Nairobi, Mombasa, and Mandera, we must be cognizant of the fact that we are all much more at risk than we were when the restrictions were in place.
And a new United Nations report this week warns of more epidemic outbreaks if governments fail to take action. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera was inaugurated Monday in the capital Lilongwe following his victory in the June 23rd election rerun. Chakwera promised to introduce various reforms to tackle corruption and improve food security in the Southern African country. But some Malawians say they have heard such promises before. Lamek Masina has the story from Blantyre.
Presidential
the inaugural ceremony was initially scheduled to accompany Independence Day celebrations at the 40,000-seat Bingu National Stadium. But Chakwera cancelled the Independence celebrations Sunday as a measure to curtail the rising number of COVID-19 cases and instead rescheduled the inauguration at Kamuzu Barracks, where only about 100 people attended. The coronavirus causes the COVID-19 disease. In his national broadcast speech, Chakwera announced several measures to develop the country, which he said has endured 26 years of poor administration while his Malawi Congress Party was in opposition.
It is no secret that we have had one administration after another shifting its post to the next election, promising prosperity but delivering poverty, promising nationalism but delivering division, promising political tolerance but delivering human rights abuses, promising good governance but delivering corruption, promising institutional autonomy but delivering state capture.
Chakwera said this left the country in ruins and therefore his first task will be clearing the rubble of corruption, laziness, donor dependency, which he says left the country's dignity in ruins. Chakwera said the corrections will not come without pain.
We must have the courage to face and endure the pain of systematic surgery if we ever want to enjoy wholeness as a nation. We must have the courage to inflict necessary pains on the fractured attitudes and actions of those around us if we ever want to see them whole as citizens.
Chakwera promised to offer himself as a servant of the people.
This means that as required by law, I will make a full declaration of my assets each year. I will go to Parliament to be questioned by the people about my handling of state affairs. I will propose legislation to reduce the powers of the presidency and empower institutions to operate independently, including Parliament and the Anti-Corruption Bureau.
Sherif Kaisi teaches political science at Blantyre International University. He said Chakwera's speech was full of hope for Malawians, but expressed doubt the new president would fulfill his promises. Kaisi spoke via telephone.
My worry is Dr. Chakwera going to live by his own words? Because such words are not new in the ears of Malawians. Every president is having a lot of promises on the table, but now it becomes a problem when it comes to practicality on the ground. So he must draw his own unit of direction and he must hit that direction.
Martha Kaluma operates a hairdressing salon in Blantyre. Kaluma told VOA via a messaging app that although Chakwera's speech sounded good to her, She's worried that he will not fulfill his promises, just like other leaders before him.
I cannot say that I believe him or I trust him 100%. Maybe I can give him 50% for now. The other 50% will come as we go along.
Chakwera said he cannot develop the country alone and will personally meet with opposition leaders every 3 months to listen to the alternative ways of running government affairs. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Former Ghanaian President John Dramani Mahama has chosen Professor Nana Jean Apuku Ajeman as his vice presidential nominee for the upcoming December 7th general election. The duo will represent the main opposition National Democratic Congress, the NDC party. Professor Apuku Ajeman becomes the first female vice presidential pick for a major Ghanaian political party. She is an academic who served as Minister of Education in Mr. Mahama's previous administration. Analysts say the choice could give the former president a significant boost from female voters in his quest to unseat incumbent President Nana Akufo-Addo in the December polls. Al-Hassan Suhini, a parliamentarian from the main opposition NDC party, tells viewers Peter Clotty that former President John Mahama made an astute pick with his vice presidential choice.
This is certainly historic and in line with the NDC tradition to always be the pace setter in Ghana's democracy. And she is not just a woman, but an accomplished one as such.
If I may ask you, Honorable Suhini, what does she bring to the table? What does she give former President John Dramani Mahama in the elections upcoming in December 7?
First of all, this is a woman who has distinguished herself in everything that she has put herself to do. She, for many people, it will be news to learn that she has been a broadcaster before. And indeed, according to the records that I saw at Radio Gold, she was the first, female to have hosted the certain president, then president, Jerry John Rawlings, to have hosted him in the studio and had an interview with him. And she's also the first female to become a university vice chancellor in Ghana. And as Minister of Education under President John Dramani Mahama in the previous administration, she led a lot of reforms, including the senior high school, the community-based senior high schools that were put up across the country to introduce the progressively free senior secondary education that the NDC championed at the time. Again, this is a woman who ensured that absenteeism at the basic level was reduced to single digits when it was over 50%. When she took over as Minister of Education. So this is a woman who, when she puts her, when she takes on a task, she delivers to satisfaction. And it is my hope that many, many women in Ghana have been looking for, this opportunity, and they have always, made the point that they have arrived and they are ready to serve. And I am sure that at this stage in our history, there is none better qualified than Nana Jean Apuku Ajeman to partner John Dramani Mahama on the NDC ticket to, govern this country and provide it with the leadership that it has always wanted or deserved.
Now, some people are suggesting that she, being a female, accomplished as she is, she might not necessarily sway the women's vote for the NDC in the upcoming elections. What is your take on this assertion?
I think only time will prove that to be wrong. I say so because she belongs to a number of fraternities of women that I know support their own, especially when they think that representative of theirs is on a good cause. She attended Wesley Girls, and we know, the influence that they wield when it comes to, politics and business. in Ghana.
Al-Hassan Suhini is a parliamentarian from Ghana's main opposition National Democratic Congress Party. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty from Accra. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has announced directives that would see the country reopen in phases from the COVID-19 shutdown. However, the president warned on Monday that restrictions on travel and public gatherings could be reimposed if the coronavirus gets out of control. Rael Ombuo reports from Nairobi.
President Uhuru Kenyatta has eased the restrictions that were put in place early March to contain the spread of the coronavirus. In a nationwide address Monday, the president said this will be a phased reopening meant to strike a balance between containing the virus and sustaining the country's economic life. He said the restrictions on movements in and out of Nairobi, considered the country's coronavirus epicenter, will end on Tuesday. Travel in and out of Mombasa and Mandera, two of five other counties still under partial lockdown, had their restrictions lifted Monday afternoon, but with conditions, Kenyatta said.
Should the situation deteriorate and pose a challenge to our health infrastructure, we will have to revert back to lockdown. In the next 21 days, we shall study patterns of interactions and the spread of the disease. Any trends that signal a worsening of the pandemic, we will have no choice but to return to lockdown at zero option.
Kenyatta's address comes as the country battles a steep rise in confirmed COVID-19 cases. Kenya is seeing about 300 new cases each day, a figure that has more than doubled in the past month. Total COVID-19 cases now stand at 7,886, with 160 deaths.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 7th. Schools in Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, reopened yesterday, Monday, after the teachers said the government threatened them with dismissal and no work, no pay. Eswatini schools have been in partial lockdown since mid-March. The country has confirmed 988 cases of the virus and 11 deaths. The government has promised to provide sanitizers, soap, and running water, social distancing also, and the wearing of face masks. Mbongwa Dlamini, president of the Swaziland National Association of Teachers, says the teachers have filed a petition with the courts, although he says the courts are controlled by the government.
The no work, no pay under normal circumstances, we understand that it is supposed to be effected if someone decides to absent himself from work. In the situation here, we have got Section 18 of the Occupational Health and Safety Act, which says teachers can remove themselves if they are exposed in a situation that poses danger on them at the workplace. So now, in this situation, teachers are being exposed to contacting the virus. Now, we expect the government as the employer to provide her workers with protective clothing. So if you are required to go to work without you being provided with the PPEs, therefore it means that you are exposed to danger. So the said regulations allow you to remove yourself if you feel you are exposed to danger. Therefore, that does not amount to abscondment because you are removing yourself because you are exposed to danger.
Did you file your petition with the courts to restrain the government? If so, do you have confidence in the Eswatini courts?
We did file the petition with the government. And as I speak, we have also served the government with the court papers. The case is to be heard tomorrow at 10:30 a.m. In actual fact, we cannot be sure what is going to happen because in Swaziland, there is no independence of the judiciary. So whether we doubt or we are sure of the verdict, it was not going to determine our action. Our action was determined by the expectation of the nation. Anyone expects that when you go to the court, that is the only place where you can get justice. It is unfortunate that in Swaziland, that doesn't happen. In as much as that doesn't happen, but we are giving it to chance so that we may see whether the courts are going to give justice to the people or not. In actual fact, as a union, we want maybe the world to know that we have done our part. We have approached the government and discussed the same matter with the government. And at times we wrote them letters and they ignored them. A number of times they decided not to respond. But now the only option that we had was to approach the courts. Our approaching the courts does not mean we have got confidence in them, but we are doing just what we're supposed to do so that whatever happens at the end, people should know that as a union, we have done everything that was within our ability.
When you returned to school on Monday, how ready were the schools?
The situation was more worse than the time we decided to close schools, because now we should understand that the numbers of those who are infected is increasing tremendously. So now these numbers are also of people who maybe in one way or the other, they are in contact with some of the students. But these students now are made to come together in a school. In that way, they are going to spread the virus.
Ubongwa Dlamini is the president of the Swaziland National Association of Teachers. He was speaking with us from the capital, Mbabane. Gambian police have charged Madi Jobate, a prominent human rights activist, with false information and broadcasting. If found guilty, he could spend between 6 months to 5 years in jail or be required to pay a fine of between $10 and $973. The charges come after Jobate granted an interview during the recent Black Lives Matter protest he organized on June 27 in front of the American Embassy in Banjul. According to local media, Jobate criticized the Gambian government for failing to investigate the deaths of three Gambian citizens who were allegedly killed by police between 2017 and 2019. Madi Jobate tells viewers Peter Clotty that his arrest and the subsequent charges against him violate his fundamental rights to free speech as guaranteed by the Gambian constitution.
I find this charge to be unlawful, to be illegal, because I have not violated any law. Rather, it is myself that has been violated, my rights as a citizen of the Gambia, who has the right to freedom of expression, and the duty to hold the government accountable, which I did in the comments that I made in the murder of Gambians where justice has not been delivered yet. And so I consider the charge as a violation of my right and the laws of the Gambia, as well as an indication of abuse of power by the state and the police in particular, because the police has no authority to question a citizen on the basis of his opinion to the point of charging that citizen for his or her opinion. That's how I feel about this charge.
Is there a situation where the statement you filed at the police station was sharply different from what you spoke out publicly for which this charge was leveled against you?
The statement I gave at the police was a very short statement because I was not prepared to give a statement. I would say I was forced to give a statement because the police commissioner maintained that unless I make a statement, I will not leave. So I just indicated that I was making that statement under duress because I was invited to the police to be questioned for my comments about police brutality, and I do not wish to make any comments for the comments. So the charge that is put on me is false publication and broadcasting. And so, but my statement remains the short statement that I gave.
What has your lawyer said about this? And what's the next line of action regarding these charges being filed against you?
Apparently, these charges are at the level of the police, at the police station. So they would have to be made at the court. And so until then, myself and my lawyers are receiving the charges as we hear them, And so the next course of action would be that I should come back to report to the police on Monday. And so there we would know, that is next week Monday, because the prosecutor said he has to send his opinion on the case to his superiors, so that by Monday we would know. We hope they will tell us when we are going to court or what they want to do next. So we are waiting to hear from them on Monday.
Madi Jobate is the prominent Gambian human rights activist. You are speaking with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Banjul. Global epidemic outbreaks will continue to emerge if governments fail to take active measures to prevent more zoonotic diseases, said the authors of a new report out this week from the United Nations Environment Programme, the UNEP, and the International Livestock Research Institute. Zoonotic diseases, which are illnesses such as Ebola and Lassa fever that jump from animals to humans, are on the rise, says Bernard Brett, one of the authors of the report.
Basically, it's because of the way we are continuing to utilize natural resources. The population is increasing, and basically agricultural intensification is leading to use of, you know, large populations of animals which are not really given enough time to develop properly and protect themselves from diseases.
Which diseases in sub-Saharan Africa specifically are increasingly being seen, having increasing in number of outbreaks or increasing intensity of outbreaks?
So we are talking of zoonotic diseases which are, we keep counting things like Ebola, things, you know, like avian influenza, things like, so these are viral diseases which jump from animals to humans.
The report also points out, though, that there are solutions. It has a specific focus on Africa because the region has responded to a number of zoonotic epidemics, and the region could be a potential source of effective solutions. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, so we are exploring, you know, more partnerships between medical, veterinary, and environment communities to develop surveillance systems. You know, you realize if there isn't good information flow across these multiple disciplines, then you wouldn't really go far in identifying where the new cases are coming from. The other main recommendation we are giving is more acceptance in markets and livestock production systems, because we need really to enhance biosecurity in these markets and also production systems. Yes, so I think the other thing is about use of technology. If we learn from things that have been done in the past, for example, in developing vaccines, in developing diagnostic systems, you are more likely to deploy them quite fast when new diseases comes up.
That was Bernard Brett, co-lead for the International Livestock Research Institute's work on emerging infectious diseases. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Nairobi, Kenya. And that's it for this Tuesday, July 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very great day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.